This is the Larry Mueller Show. I am Jill Nadeau, and I am really looking forward to talking with our next guest. Roxana Julepot is here to talk about her new book, Morning Baker, Recipes and Rituals for Breakfast and Beyond. She is head baker and co-owner of Friends and Family, a bakery in Los Angeles. And her first book, in case and you might have heard of it, is the critically acclaimed Mother Grains. What do you want to know about baking? Are you having difficulty getting your bread to rise? Or maybe you'd like to try croissants? Give us a call because you've got an expert right here. Or send us an email to talk at WPR.org. Roxana, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Good morning, Jill. I'm thrilled to be here.
You know, usually I kind of feel bad when we talk to people from the West Coast because we're kind of early, but you know, you've been up probably since 2, so I don't feel too bad.
I'm good. I'm definitely good. I'm on many cups of coffee, running on all cylinders.
Good. I'm glad. So your book just came out beginning of the month, right?
So, that is correct.
Yeah. So have you been doing a lot of interviews?
Yeah. And I've also been doing a little bit of a tour. I've visited 2 cities already, and I'm about to head into the longest leg of the tour, including a visit to you guys.
Wonderful. So when you're out actually doing a tour physically, do you go out and visit other bakeries and see what they're all about?
You know it. First thing in the morning.
And do you talk to the bakery afterwards or before? Do they get nervous when you're there?
No, I don't know what it is. You know, I remember when I was more of a fine dining private chef, I would go to restaurants and you definitely would have to introduce yourself and go shake hands in the kitchen every now and again. And you would address the guy, mostly a guy in charge, and say, "Hello, chef." And then when the vibe completely changes with bakers.
Really?
Bakers are peers. We see each other head to head.
Uh-huh.
So it's more like, "Hi, my name is Roxana. Oh, okay. Who's the head baker? Oh, great. This everything was so lovely." And you may not even talk to the head baker. Anybody in the bakery is, you know, probably well-versed on the going-ons of the bakery.
Sure. It was really interesting reading your book because even before you get to the recipes, and I know you probably the same way, but when you get a cookbook, you read it. You read it like a book, right? Do you do that?
I do that,
yes,
yep.
Yes.
That's most of my reading time, yes.
Reading cookbooks. I mean, people look at me sometimes, "You were reading a cookbook?" It's like, yeah, that's the most important part. But the beginning of yours is really, really interesting. And you talk about what it's like to start your day and, you know, getting up at 2 and getting to work at 3. And you describe it so, so well. Why don't you explain a little bit to our listeners what it's like in the early mornings like that?
You know, I definitely have learned to embrace the early morning. I feel like the minute the alarm goes off, the day feel like it has so much potential. It's like this secret wedge of time that only works for you, you know, while everybody else is asleep. You have an advantage on everybody else already. So, you know, I go about my morning rituals, which are always the same. I always wake up, do a little bit of a meditation, make sure I'm grounded and ready for the day, feed my cat, give him a few pets, head out the door. And as soon as I walk in, we will, you know, do all the things, turning on ovens, etc. But, you know, the first button I probably press is the coffee maker. And also, I have a group of people joining me pretty soon after. So it's a pretty convivial social time. And those who are not really social at that time of day eventually become more chatty and more engaged.
Is that where the rituals part of your title comes from?
100%.
Yeah.
I feel like that repetition is such a sort of like a safety blanket. I can always count on what I'm just going to do what I'm supposed to do next. And before you know, you're on a roll.
Literally and figuratively.
Literally, quite literally.
Absolutely. And your crew, like you said, there's no one person that like does everything. Everybody has their purpose and the thing that they do best. And then you have people from all over with different backgrounds too.
Yeah, also, we live in Los Angeles. So as you can imagine, that we speak probably about 5 or 6 languages in the big shop. We know how to say good morning in most of them. And also, you know, many people in baking, I'm sure that this is true everywhere, not just in LA. Some people come to baking as a second career. So before they join the team, they have a whole history. And that just makes it for a lot of fun conversation.
For sure. Now, as did you. Now, you didn't just become a baker. You were a journalist. So what was that journey like from being a journalist to becoming where you are today?
You know, very, very fascinating, because I always knew that, well, I've always loved to spend time in the kitchen. And my family is pretty, you know, I don't want to say that they're academic, but they definitely encourage that you do that thing, you know,
sure,
as parents do. And it was probably halfway through college that I told my mom that I would want to go to cooking school. And she looked at me like so incredulous, like, why would anyone, right? And then I remember I sold it to her as in like, well, I can write about food and agriculture. I had done an internship in an institute for agriculture, so it made a lot of sense. And then after I moved to the States, this is back home in Costa Rica. After I moved back to the States, I was only 23 years old, and the jobs that people would give me were like, I was a translator for a long time. Mm-hmm. I work as a translator while I went through cooking school. And it was, you know, hilarious. Like you have your whiteies all morning in your school lab doing all your chopping and learning how to make sauces. And then you change and you go to an office and your hands smell like onions. Just really funny. But it was pretty, pretty seamless. I felt really, really comfortable in the kitchen from day one.
That's kind of the key, isn't it? You know that you're actually... You feel at home, and you know this is the place that you need to be. But you didn't start out being a baker. You were doing pastry, right? Is that where you kind of started?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, this is now it seems like it was just yesterday, but it has been 20 something years. But in the beginning, I took the course for all the disciplines. You know, most culinary school programs are about 1.5 or 2 years. And you do, you know, first you do introduction, and then you do like all the hot foods, then you do garmanger or in somewhat of that order. And then of course I I got into the workforce, my preference would have been to be a line cook, but all the jobs I could land were like pastry and pantry, which usually were one and the same. And then I'm like, well, you know what? I really like this. I'm comfortable here. And, you know, that's how I just kind of like got pushed in that direction. And mm-hmm. then I was a pastry chef for many, many years before I decided what would happen if I worked during the day instead of closing this restaurant in the middle of the night. And here we are.
So you went from one extreme to the other, basically, time-wise.
Pretty much, yes.
Yeah. So did you open your own bakery right away, or did you work for somebody else to kind of learn the ropes?
You know, when I first started many, 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 many years ago, I was hired to work at this restaurant called Campanile that is famously owned by Nancy Silverton. And she had also founded this other somewhat famous bakery called La Brea Bakery, definitely very famous by the time I started working there. So I would see, as I would be closing the pastry kitchen for the night, I would see the midnight bakers come and do their thing. And I felt like it was a very tough gig, to be really honest. And every now and again, I would hang out for like, you know, a couple hours just to see what they were doing. And they did really fun things. So I really, really enjoyed their task. I didn't quite enjoy their schedule. So, and then by the time I wanted to open a bakery, I felt like, you know, I had been a runner for a few years. I had done a lot of early mornings, and I was just like, and I was doing more early nights. So I felt like it was just a matter of timing, you
sure.
know, where you are in life. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That happens a lot. We're talking with Roxana Julepat. She is the co-author of the new book, Morning Baker, Recipes and Rituals for Breakfast and Beyond. And we're going to talk a little bit more about the actual book in just a second. And if you've got any questions, give us a call, 800-642-1234. And of course, you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Coming up at noon, we'll talk about World Premiere Wisconsin. That's a year-long festival that brings attention to plays and musicals that debut in our state. But right now, we are talking about baking. And I just want to say that this book has the most beautiful pictures in it, Roxana. Did you do these pictures yourself, or did you have did the book company do it for you, or how did that come about?
So we had an excellent team, incidentally, it's the same team we used for Mother Grains, my first cookbook.
Okay.
So we had a vibe already. I feel like that definitely translates. And right before we took the photography, we had a conversation, and I was just like, I don't know what you guys have to do, but just make sure that it feels like it's 6 a.m. in California. We want that sunlight.
Oh, it is beautiful, and you definitely capture that. And I mean, I think that the color of any baked goods that's made with whole grains is so much richer than the typical white bread, don't you?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Color is definitely one of the most one of the strongest excuses start baking with whole grains. Absolutely.
Yeah, because they taste as good as they look then, too. So let's talk a little bit about that. Let's talk a little bit about whole grains and why you use them and why you've written two books about them.
You know, it all started kind of like because my inclination has always been super strong to bake with whatever is around, right? The best fruits, the best vegetables. We also live in like an agricultural mecca. Some of our farmers markets are considered the best in the country, right? Not to brag, but, you know. And they are also, we have very long seasons. You know, we will have strawberries, they just started. Kind of like in the middle of March, and we will see them, excellent strawberries, almost all the way to October, you know? That is pretty enviable, right?
It is,
so
it is.
When farmers started to bring little bits of grain that they were growing, I'm like, okay, here's a new ingredient. Like, I can't believe how boring my flour supply is. It's the same, and it has been the same for years. The thing that I use the most, it was just like, plain and boring. So what a great opportunity, right? It gave me a second wind in my baking. It really, really, really allowed me to reinvent all kinds of things that I thought I knew and had mastered for years.
And it, you still continue to reinvent these recipes because you're continuing to get newer grains and different combinations. And yeah, that's very exciting. It keeps everything fresh.
Yep. That's definitely true.
Yeah, for sure. So how did you decide which recipes you were going to include in this book? And there are a lot of them, but I'm sure you didn't put all of your recipes in there.
You know, that's a funny story. Actually, this book, the first manuscript was 600 pages long.
Oh, my gosh.
And as soon as I sent it out, and it was like more all-encompassing. It was more divided by time of day, and it included recipes for lunch and dinner and dessert, right? And as soon as I pressed send on that email, I was like, I feel that this book needs to be a breakfast cookbook. And immediately I called my co-author, Ari Smolin, who lives in Boston. And I was like, this needs to be a breakfast book. And she's like, yep, I've been saying this for the last year. And I'm like, fantastic. And it was already 300 pages, just the breakfast section. So, you know, we actually had more than we needed. And all these recipes were part of like a very intuitive sort of like more like brainstormy, The process was very stream of consciousness. Okay, we love buckwheat. What kind of muffin are we going to do with buckwheat? And what are we going to put in it? And we know we love apples and buckwheat. So boom, there you go.
Mm-hmm.
So that is our process.
So are these, some of these recipes, things that people can find in your bakery, or are most of them unique to the cookbook?
So if you ever came to Friends and Family, you would realize that things are, that we have sort of like a reliable couple dozen or maybe three dozen items that you see on the reg, right? Mm-hmm. They're always there. They're well-loved favorites. If we took them off the case, there would probably be some serious complaints, right? But we also host all kinds of little events to make the most out of little celebrations or times of year. So, for example, we just had our strawberry festival. So it's a day that is actually a weekend, and we do all kinds of little goodies with strawberries. So that day, we're adding 10 to 12 new items to the repertoire just because we have all these crazy ideas roaming in our head, and like they want to come out. So that's kind of like how a good way to channel all this like recipe creation that is always in a process of evolution.
Sure.
And soon enough, as soon as I come back from the tour, there will be a cherry fest because we start getting cherries here around Mother's Day here in LA.
Well, Wisconsin's a big cherry state, so we have
Yeah,
that perked up a lot of people's ears, I'm sure. Lots of cherry recipes around here. So, absolutely.
I love it.
Now, you mentioned in your book that, you know, putting fresh fruit in bakery isn't an easy task because there's so much moisture in it. How do you compensate for that? I know you said something about you'd like to maybe use dried fruit or maybe jam. Is that some of your go-to ways?
So, you know, that's also another way of like maximizing the season, right? Like we will make a lot of jam and preserves or compotes, etc. I do like to do a little bit of compote because then you have already thickened the juices. Also a really good way to use fruit and not have like that sort of bleedy situation in a lot of your goodies is to freeze the fruit prior. A great technique that I love for all of you cherry lovers, and I do have cherry envy of the Midwest, by the way, and I can't wait for an excuse to be there in the middle of July one year.
But you definitely should come,
right? And people are like, but the humidity. I'm like, I'm a Costa Rican girl. Don't worry.
Oh, gosh. It's nothing like Costa Rica.
But I would say the one thing, one cool trick that I find with cherries is that cherries are like tremendously sweet, super, super juicy. And yeah, as much as I want to believe that just tossing them with a little bit of cornstarch and sugar and a teeny bit of butter, like that would make a great filling, I feel like it's hard to nail. It's super hard to nail that sort of perfect balance of thickening and juiciness. So what I've come to find out is that if we cook half of the cherries in the pie and then combine them with equal amounts of raw cherries, that makes a tremendous pie filling that sort of like where you kind of like gave your fruit a leg up. And by the time your pie is fully baked, your juicy thickening factor is pretty on the money.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. And the textures, I'm assuming, would be pretty nice, too, so they wouldn't all be one, right?
It's very, exactly, it's very jammy, but you have, like, the meaty morsels of cherry.
Oh, that sounds so good. I'm going to have to try that. We got an email. Grant emailed to say he's been experimenting with egg whites in place of water in some of his bread doughs. He's using 100% egg whites as liquid for 100% whole wheat bread. It appears that the use of egg whites strengthens the dough and lightens the texture of the finished bread. Do you have any experience using egg whites in bread doughs in this way?
No, this is a new one. I would say that it does make sense that there's a little bit of strengthening because egg whites are notorious for their protein content. They also already add viscosity and the ability to gel, right? No, I haven't. I have to say I haven't. What I do like about adding just plain water besides the cost, right? is that what it does to all that bran in our dough, like, needs to hydrate, needs to really soak up that liquid. And that's why, like, breads, all breads, but definitely breads made with whole grain, require some sitting time, a little resting periods, and that really, really allows this bran to lubricate and sort of, like, live up to its full potential, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, while I think that egg whites could do some of that, I would make sure that maybe they are more at room temperature so that they are really easily, more easily absorbed. And I would say maybe lighten it up with a little bit of water wouldn't be a bad idea.
Yeah, great. Well, keep experimenting, Grant. Thank you for sharing that with us. We're talking to Roxana Julepat. She is the co-author of the new book, Morning Baker, Recipes and Rituals for Breakfast and Beyond. If you've got a question, give us a call, 800-642-1234. Or you can be like Grant and send us an email. That's talk@WPR.org. So when you're working with whole grains, you mentioned about letting it set. What are some of the other things that you really need to do to create some really good bakery?
The best thing that anybody can do, and that's something that I can do here at home, that's something that you can do at home, Jill. There is fantastic grain in the Midwest, by the way. Incredible, also artisan mills that mm-hmm. do a fantastic job. Really, really great local varieties too. I would say the best thing that you can do to really, really sort of add a little oomph to your baking and even upgrade your whole grain baking if you're already dabble into it, is to find the best source of flour available. We're not asking go buy caviar, it's flour. So even if you're buying top grade, it's not so much money that it will break the bank. And the returns on that investment are just so exponentially great, that is absolutely a must and a win-win in every situation. And also, grain has this advantage of being very regional. So in doing in purchasing this kind of flours, you're totally encouraging your local miller, your local farmer, to keep doing the work, because it's quite hard, you know. Agriculture is super risky, and grain agriculture particularly so. I would recommend in your area, it's actually a mill in Illinois. It's called Janie's Mill. And they do a fantastic, fantastic job. There's two varietals I love that they mill into really beautiful flour. One is called Frederick, and is what I would consider an all-purpose whole grain flour. Fantastic to make cakes and scones and cookies. And also a powerhouse of the Midwest is called Turkey Red. It's a hard red wheat that makes a super strong flour and fantastic for bread making.
And you, in your book, have two or three pages listing all the different kinds and where you can get them and the names. And it's so funny because you refer to page 313 a lot. And so I have that memorized, like, oh, page 313. So there's a lot of information in there.
You can't ask people to go upgrade their flour, you know, and go champion all these grains without giving the tools to do so, right?
And make it easy. Don't make it difficult, right? Yeah,
right. Absolutely. And we do shop so much online these days, you know? And mm-hmm. all of this, I made sure that all the granaries or grain shops or mills or farmers on the list are doing that kind of e-commerce, so that, you know, we're not like, oh, bummer, I just can't get it over
here. Yeah, because there are some places where you just, I mean, you know, you're in a smaller area that just doesn't make sense for people to carry it. So, yeah.
Right.
We've got a phone call from Sharon in De Pere. Go right ahead, Sharon.
Hi, Roxana. My question is, I have two family members who are celiac, and do you have much experience with gluten-free bakery, or can you recommend a good brand of flour to use?
Go ahead.
Hi, Sharon. Sharon, this is a very common question. It pops up all the time. So, of course, as any baker, I have dabbled in gluten-free, actually quite a bit. The only reason why I'm really, really careful to not offer gluten-free products at my bakeries. Like, I don't want to be perceived as a place that is safe for people that are celiac disease. So because the cross-contamination is inevitable, and I can't guarantee that you can safely eat this product. Here in LA is like the mecca of every diet and every food substitution you can think of. So I have to be very clear and very careful when I offer wheat-free products. This happened to me years ago when I was discovering fantastic grain from all over. I decided that I was going to make my own blend of gluten-free flour, because everything I found in the market was full of starches and gums and things that I was not understanding, you know. And I'm like, I am an ingredient-driven person. I want to make sure I know everything that goes in my flour. So I came up with a little bit of a formula that has worked for me in most things. I wouldn't say that is one of those like one-for-one, infallible formulas, but it does do really well in most everything, from pancakes to muffins to pound cake, right? And this is a very easy recipe. I do one part brown rice flour, one part oat flour, and one part buckwheat flour. Just make sure that all the flours are whole grain, and this is for good reason. All that bran in all those ingredients actually add a lot of body to your bakes, which is something we lack when we're making gluten-free products, right? And of course, I'm sure anybody who's done some gluten-free baking knows that we have to rely on a few ingredients that are not common to baking, like xanthan gum or guar gum. So yeah, you can still use those to achieve better results, but these flours have properties that help the flour sustain a bake without collapsing. Like the buckwheat itself is a little bit gummy by nature, so that adds a little viscosity to the dough. Oat flour is very fluffy and briny, so it holds onto liquid in a nice way. And brown rice flour gives you a fine texture. Mm-hmm. So they all contribute a little something. I have had really good luck with this recipe.
I was looking at that because I'm a little sensitive myself, so I'm always looking at it. And I've never, you know, it's really hard to find a recipe that doesn't have a trillion ingredients, right, to it. And it's like, oh my gosh, I've got to buy so much stuff. And that one was extremely simple. And it did sound like it would be, you know, I love getting these recipes from people like you who love bakery. And so you're not going to put it out there if it doesn't taste good. So, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It does taste good. Mm-hmm. That is ultimately the most important thing. It tastes good. It browns right. It does all those things that we pay attention to. It's real food. It's real food.
Yeah. Exactly. It's like, I don't want to eat it then. If it's gluten-free, I don't want to eat it if it tastes terrible. So it's like,
right,
I'll do without.
Right.
So,
please.
Right.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit more about your book. So you divided it up into different sections. Like we said earlier, there's like over 300 pages here with all kinds of great information, super pictures, but there's not like that many, that there's a lot of recipes in here. Your first chapter is muffins, and we all love those morning muffins. But one of the things that I really picked up on is that you talk about the pan, and not a lot of times you hear about the pan, because that's an important part of it too. So tell us what kind of pan you like to use.
You know, muffin pans are great because they're very affordable. You can buy them sometimes even at your grocery store, right? I tend to like the ones that are coated because they will prevent a lot of sticking. And they're also like, in the old days, Teflon would like peel off your pan, you know? Like, these are pretty resistant. You still have to be careful and use non-corrosive wipes to wash them. But they are pretty affordable, even if they're coated. And what I like about those is that anything that's metal is a great conductor of heat. But not only that, because they're coated, you may not need a liner. And that's kind of like a plus, in my opinion. I like that. But if you wanted to use a liner, it's okay.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of the liners. Yeah, I'm not a fan of those myself. You lose so much of the muffin on the liner.
Right, right. I mean, they're good if you're packing them for school lunches and such, but
Yeah. I saw a video of you making your chocolate muffins, I think it was, which they look amazing. But I noticed that you took a flat, small spatula and just kind of put, wedge them out just a teeny tiny little bit,
yes,
and then took them out with your hands. And that made so much sense because I tend to, like, you know, flap them over, but then you lose some sometimes.
Right. And also one thing that we've learned from making muffins over the years is that, like, if you pull them when they're slightly warm, like warm enough to the point that you can, like, cool enough that you can handle them, mm-hmm, but not so cool that, like, they are just really, like, stuck, you know? Or your pan should still feel a little bit, careful.
Touch,
you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. But, that does make, an easier dislodging.
And you were nice enough and your publisher was nice enough to share a recipe with us. And when the audio for this will be published about 2:00, you'll be able to go to our website. So WPR.org/Larry, go to this episode and scroll down a little bit and you'll see the recipe. You'll be able to click on it. You'll be able to see the recipe with a really pretty picture. The picture has some of these and a couple of other, but it is a scone that is, what's the name of it? It's cheddar, jalapeno, cornmeal, I believe. So tell us about this recipe because it sounds so good. And unfortunately, I didn't have a chance to try it, but I definitely want to. So tell us about that.
I love the idea of a savory scone, don't you?
Me too.
Right? Yeah. It's good to not have just all that all sugary stuff all the time. So what I like about this recipe is that it's also kind of like for lazy people. Right? Let's say that you're not totally together. It's also like a great hungover breakfast. So then, you know, you just woke up, you have your ingredients. It does have cornmeal, which is really, really terrific with this sort of Southwest flavors, mm-hmm, jalapeno and singy jalapenos, and like that melty cheese. So that works really well. And, like, you know, normally scones are made over the counter, and you shape them into a circle and you cut them like a cake and they have that wedge, beautiful shape. But that's work, right? So
yes.
What I like about this style is that they're more like a drop biscuit or a drop scone, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you just make a fine mess in your bowl and then they end up, you make little lumps. And then you bake them off. So it's kind of like I imagine you've done after a rough night out and really craving some coffee and something spicy. And, you know, they are delicious right out of the oven. When they're hot, they also sit well. And they're a great standing for cornbread.
Mm-hmm.
So you can hold some for dinner and eat them with your chili.
Yeah, I was going to say for chili, I'm sure it was amazing with that. Again, like I said, you can take a look at that. You can print it out, do whatever you want to with it, and try it out. It's such a classic combination. When it comes to cornmeal, I've noticed in some of your recipes, you said you could have the coarse or a little bit like medium grind. There's a difference between the two. And sometimes people don't think about that, but then there's a really fine too. So why would you want to have coarse or medium and not the fine?
I tend to land somewhere in the middle, but I do realize that a lot of people don't have access to finer grinds, or, you know, you just find what you find, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And also some people will make it at home. You know, I have found those people, they exist. Not advantage or disadvantage. We just have to sort of like realize that if it's a little thicker, it will need a little bit more time to soften, right? So, for example, if you're making a classic cornbread, you would make your batter and maybe let it sit. Let it sit for a few minutes, half an hour before you put it in the oven. And just that amount of time lets the crunchy little bits sort of hydrate. And then by the time it bakes, they're a little bit more supple and not quite as toothy. Now, if you like that texture, by all means, bake it right away. The one thing that we have to be careful with cornmeal is that if you are using them indiscriminately, let's say, you must use the amount by weight rather than by cups, which is a volume measure, because if you are doing a cup of cornmeal that is supposed to be coarse, if you were using fine, you're using a lot more, right? Mm-hmm. So as long as you're working with weights, you will be on the safe side and not make something like dense and stodgy.
And let's talk about that in just a second. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. We're talking with Roxana Julepot. She's the co-author of the new book, Morning Baker, Recipes and Rituals for Breakfast and Beyond. And if you've got a baking question, please give us a call, 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Tomorrow on Garden Talk, we'll check in with Lindsay Hendricks from the Green Bay Botanical Gardens, and then we'll talk about how to attract birds, bees, butterflies, and all those other wonderful pollinators to your garden. Hope you can join us for that. But right now, we are talking about baking, and before we went to the break, we were talking about measuring versus weighing, which is becoming more and more the thing these days. I think we all maybe started thinking about this when we started watching the Great British Baking Show. At least I know I did. It's like, oh, they're measuring it. Why? Well, they don't have a cup. Why don't you explain the differences and why it's kind of important to weigh instead of, you know, dump?
It is so interesting. I really insisted on writing a section right next to the introduction that is called Your cup is not my cup. And that is precisely the issue at hand, right? That like, if I give you a one cup measure and right next to you, I scale one cup of flour and you did the same, I guarantee you that if we put those on a scale, on a balance, they will be different because the way you compact your flour might be different from the way I do it.
Yes.
Also, the way your flour bag has been sitting in a cupboard for a year, right? Let's say that you don't bake that often and it's getting nice and compact in there. Like, well, I've milled my own. So that is a completely different volume, right?
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah, we've learned that like for more consistency, scaling, weighing out your ingredients is so much better.
Mm-hmm. And in your book, you have both. So you've got the cup measure and you've got the weight. And like you had mentioned before we went to the break, you know, a cup of one kind of cornmeal is going to be different than a cup of another. So it's really important. And like you also mentioned, is that a scale does not cost very much. And it doesn't
not
have to be
much.
Super... You can change it from ounces to grams, and it's super easy to use. And I love mine, so I recommend it to everyone.
Right.
Yeah, just get a scale. It's fun. And then you kind of feel like you're an expert, you know, if you're weighing out your stuff. So,
absolutely.
Yeah. So Renee in Viroqua called but couldn't stay with us, and she wanted to ask your opinion of silicone bakeware. She said, is it worthwhile?
You know, it is actually incredibly efficient.
Mm-hmm.
You do have to take good care of it. And I think that sometimes people think that it is just a magic product, right?
Right.
And then they're surprised when something sticks to it. The one thing that I would say is that they are incredibly durable, right? They are also low cost. They come in a variety of sizes and styles. But I still address them as if they are regular metalware. Right. And I do like to do a little bit of nonstick spray, or if you like oiling and buttering, still do those things. They are less prone to stickiness, but they still stick a little bit. So help yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And just definitely like wash not by hand. I don't put them in the dishwasher. Allow them to dry so that they don't mold. All of those like common sense moves, they really extend the life of siliconware. But I really like it. They're tough on restaurants and bakeries that our volume is such that it is a little tough, like the wear can be significant, but it's they're still pretty useful.
I've tried them before, but I didn't like the fact that they were kind of
bendy.
Yes. So, have you solved that problem at all, or?
Well, you always should have a baking sheet to
underneath.
Put them on. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've had some incidents. We won't get into that. So as well as biscuits and scones, you talk about pancakes and friends, as you say, donuts and fritters, croissants, which I'm like, wow, you tackle croissants with whole grains. Impressive. Also breads. And then you have some other things kind of sprinkled in. But let's talk about croissant dough. I mean, as we talk about croissants, it's not just the little triangles that we've seen.
Right.
You can make a lot of things with croissant dough. So with whole grain croissant dough, what are some of the things that you run into that's different than if you're making it with a traditional white flour?
You know, croissants, regardless of the flour, are a challenging next-level type of bake, right?
Yes.
So with that in mind, you know, the first thing you must do is give yourself a lot of grace and understand that this is definitely a hard technique to learn for anybody, even professionals. The one thing that whole grain adds to the equation is that we do have that brand, right? A lot of these techniques we're constantly stretching.
Better?
It can make our dough a little bit breaky.
We got a question from Perry in Oconto. Perry, do you have a question for us? Go right ahead. Perry, are you there? Go right ahead.
Great. I love whole grain breakfast cereals. I'm kind of a whole road oat man, and I eat it both cooked and also just soaked overnight or a few hours. Do you have any other grains that I should be looking for that would complement that or be a change of pace?
I love that you're asking this question, Perry. Yes, I do, actually. So a great, great whole grain breakfast is polenta. I don't know if you're familiar with that. It's basically similar to cornmeal. It's a different variety of corn, but it does make a coarse meal that you actually can cook it over a little bit of water and milk, or a combination of the two. And that is, it can be savory or sweet. You can add a little bit of honey and a lump of butter, and it's delicious. Or even a little fruit is delicious. Or you can just have it plain with a little bit of salt, some Parmesan, as we do for dinner also. But it's a nice hot cereal. Also, the way you eat your oats, you can do with rye flakes. And you can do with barley flakes, which have a nice toothy feel. The two other great ways to eat your morning grains.
Excellent. Well, thank you for that question, Perry. I never would have thought about that. That sounds really good. Certainly better than some of the cereals that we can get at the grocery store.
And a lot more filling.
Definitely filling. We had talked about that recipe that you shared with us, which is a scone. And I've always wondered, and a lot of people do wonder, and I've seen questions, what are the difference between American scones and British scones?
Oh, this could be an essay for sure. But, you know, it's really interesting. I train under American bakers and pastry chefs, and I always found it very interesting how we are very creative with them, right? Like, we see all kinds of ingredients in there, a lot of toppings, beautiful glazes. And sure, are there a lot of bad scones out in the world? For sure. But whenever you see like a really tight, delicious scone with like a beautiful glaze, it's usually an American baker putting it out.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go to Great Britain, any of the territories, and like you have found one of their scones and you're like mystified. Why is this so plain? Why is this so simple? Because they actually don't put anything in them. Or you can have them plain with clotted cream, sometimes a little jam, and or curd, and you can have them with currants. I would say, and they are definitely more meant to be eaten for, you know, afternoon tea. I would say that I really like what we've done with scones here on this side of the pond. I feel like our scones are built for breakfast. And like, if they make you want to go drink that latte and go go on with your day, you know? They're a complete baked good that doesn't need that extra clotted cream or jam.
You can eat them on the go, where with the,
yes,
the British scone,
yes,
you have to
best.
Sit down to have your tea and add
And we
your...
also have so much variety. It keeps you coming back for more.
Yeah, always. We do a lot of cranberry scones around here because we do so many grow so many cranberries.
Right.
So those are always very yummy. So, so besides your bakery, you also opened a pizza place.
Right.
Why did you decide to go into pizza?
You know, it was kind of like an opportunity, an old spot in a place here in LA called Historic Farmers Market, because it is kind of historic. It's been there since the 60s, 50s, 60s. And the stall that had the pizza oven opened up and they offered it to us. And we're like, we can make pizza.
Of course.
My husband runs the bakery with me. He's a chef also.
Okay.
So he was like, just worry about the dough. Just make us great dough. And I tested the dough, and the dough was like surprisingly easy, because we do natural leaven pizza. It's a sourdough base pizza.
Oh.
And once you're on a roll, once you're on a system, mm-hmm. the dough is incredibly forgiving and really always tastes amazing. So executable that I could train other people to do. So that was amazing.
So
it worked really well.
Yeah. So and we had mentioned you do sourdough bread and your own starter,
right,
and all with these whole grains. How does that affect a sourdough?
You know, I think I probably don't know the answer, because I've always baked sourdough with whole grain.
Okay.
I never did white flour. Mm-hmm. Isn't that funny?
Yes.
So I would imagine that the whole grain is a lot more nutritious. So sometimes, you know, for example, when we add rye flour to our sourdough, the sourdough rye goes crazy, right? It's so available, like the nutrients are so available to the culture that it just really, really runs a little bit faster.
Okay.
Or like yeah, it encourages it to do all its things. But also, like, sourdough is a great metabolizer, right? Like, that fermentation process makes the bread more digestible. And I think that probably makes the whole grain a lot more digestible. So that's an added benefit.
Well, that
like
makes
sense. That symbiotic relationship is really what makes whole grain sourdough so delicious and
sure.
so good for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that information is in the book also.
That's right.
Yeah. So you had mentioned earlier that your first book was like 600 pages. So can we look forward to lunch coming up and dinner soon? Are we going to have volumes coming up?
You know, it was that kind of thing that I'm like, what can you do with grain for lunch? And you end up making a lot of grain salads and sandwiches, right?
Yeah.
So I'm like, maybe I'm going to let this to the savory chefs. I'm going to leave this to the savory chefs.
There you go.
Yeah.
Sounds good. All right. Well, thank you so much for being with us, Roxana. We really appreciate it. And best of luck with this book. I really encourage people to take a look at it, because it's a fun journey. So thank you for being with us.
Thank you. And I can't wait to see you guys when I come visit on book tour.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Roxana Julepat is the co-author of the new book, Morning Baker: Recipes and Rituals for Breakfast and Beyond. Pick it up, and we'll be back in a little bit with more.